everybody. This is Patricia Corey, author, channel of The Syrian Revelations, coming to you live on bbsradio.com to help you navigate your way through the maze of conventional thought so that you can soar out into the beyond, the free thought zone, beyond the matrix. And before I introduce my guest tonight, again, we're late going on the air because of the phone line, so please don't leave us. When you come on to listen, and there might be a small delay, you just stick with us because it's technical, okay? I just want to update you on the SoulQuest Journeys program. So delighted that so many of you are registering for the Avalon Crop Circle program in July. In fact, I might have to open this up to more people because the space is almost gone. So please get in touch with me on that. The Peru program in September now has only 12 spaces left, too. So please think carefully if you want to be part of these experiences. And book. It's not a promotion. It's not a gimmick. It's about space. Okay? You can get all the info on www.syrianrevelations.net. Let's bring our highest thoughts and our music into the PowerPoints of this great planet. Okay, that's the blurb. I want to introduce you to my guest tonight. It's a real honor to have him on. His name is Daniel Pinchbeck. He's been described as one of the leading voices in today's counterculture, and that is what we want here on Beyond the Matrix. Daniel's a fabulous author. He's the author of Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism, which I haven't read yet. And the book that has drawn me to him is entitled 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. And on the cover is the fabulous Julia Sett crop circle, which those of you who know me know had a life-altering impact on me. So synchronicity drew me to this wonderful author, and he's here tonight to introduce to you some of his experience and incredible insights into the spirit journey. Hello, Daniel. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sorry, we've got a little bit of a delay, so we might overspeak into each other's conversation. So I'll probably delay a minute between questions and answers. Thank you, first of all, for your utter honesty and transparency, which underlies your writing. The idea of coming out and speaking openly about your experience with psychedelics and how they have, let's say, catapulted you into higher passages of spiritual awakening might turn off a lot of purists and skeptics. So personally, I celebrate your willingness to openly share that aspect of your life, your spiritual life, and share that with the readers. So we'll be talking about that, yes?
No, thank you.
Tell me, Daniel, I would like to start by asking you the question that I asked you earlier on the phone. How did you choose the crop circle Julia set as the powerful image for the cover of your book?
Well, I mean, it was a choice of the graphic designer. I mean, I had given her a few of the crop circle yearbooks produced by Steve and Karen Alexander, and that was the one that she chose to use. I do mention that one in the book I'm talking about because it was, I think it appeared in 1997 near Stonehenge, and it was one of the ones that's more verifiably remarkable in terms of its origin because somebody had gone past the field one way and then came back the other way and saw it 45 minutes later. So I didn't direct
it. Yeah, that's right.
No, it was the designer, yeah.
You're cutting out a bit. Can you maybe, are you moving around with your telephone?
Let me see. I'll try that instead. Hello, can you hear me?
Well, you keep cutting out. See, if you could just maybe find a comfortable spot and
I'm talking,
I'll tell you if you're coming through clearly.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, that sounds good. We'll go with that.
Okay.
Okay, great. So you didn't actually get into this crop circle then?
No, that was years before I explored them.
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, you cut out again, Daniel. Sorry about that. Are you there? 1, 2, 3, 4.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, great. I got you now. Okay, well, yeah, this crop circle was definitely a transformational moment in the whole crop circle phenomenon. And I just thought it was remarkable that it was on the cover of your book, especially since I was drawn to your work for the 2012 aspect. So anyway, since your book talks constantly about synchronicity, I do want you to know that I found that to be quite a synchronistic aspect of being drawn to you. So the title is 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. Would you like to give us just a brief on what that means, what you're going to talk about in this work?
Yeah, well, 2012 is the conclusion of the Mayan calendar, December 21st, 2012. And so that was one focus of the book, what that might mean. And Quetzalcoatl is the feathered serpent of Mesoamerican mythology. And as an archetype, Quetzalcoatl represents kind of a principle of integration. So it's the meaning of heaven and earth or spirit and matter. It represents the meaning of the bird and the snake. So part of the book was an attempt to understand the Mayan calendar, what these cycles might mean, and then what I began to realize was that part of it was this idea of integration of knowledge systems. So the Western knowledge system, science, and the indigenous shamanic tradition, Eastern metaphysics, are all kind of coming together at this time to create a kind of new form of consciousness.
Yeah, indeed. And, of course, there's so much fear, just the divide between anticipation and fear about 2012 is really coming into the foreground in the collective mind now. So it's very refreshing to read another work which talks about an uplifting, transformational experience for all of us ahead, and how we are co-creating that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Early on in the book, in fact, you tell the reader that you will do your best to unpack and explain what you mean by the transformation of consciousness, and you do a great job of that, elaborating the convergence of science and mysticism. Can you give us an idea of the essence of that transformation as you describe it in the book?
Yeah, well, I mean, I look at it from different ways, and I think part of it is about kind of people learning to take responsibility for their situation. I think in Western society we've become very passive. We've gotten into this kind of consumer mindset, and we expect things to be taken care of for us. And now we can see that's not really going to be the way things necessarily go. If we look at what happened after Katrina or 9/11, so I think one aspect is people really learning how to take responsibility and to collaborate and sort of reinvent their social realities. And I'm really interested in movements like the Transition Town movement in the United Kingdom, which is all these people in towns and cities across the country who are getting together to think about how to prepare for peak oil and climate change, and then pressuring their local governments to make actual tangible shifts. So I think there's a very practical and material, base to it. We're moving into a situation of, resource shortage, and obviously the species extinction crisis is growing rapidly. So we're going to need to have some kind of new collaborative framework for working together to stop the destructive processes that we've unleashed. And then I think there's a potentially also a kind of psychic element to it, which I discuss. One way to look at it is if you think about the 18th century and the discovery of electricity, that people had never, had seen lightning, but they had no idea you could use that to change the planet's grid and to create a global industrial culture. And so at the moment, we may be
on the cusp of being able to access a different type of energy, which would be psychic energy for transformation. And so that's something that I think is possible. We might find ourselves able to, you know, on a planetary level, do kind of psychic work to help the climate and so on.
Yeah, it's interesting how it seems that human nature, that we have to just take things to the limit before we collectively raise our sights to what is possible and on a very high level. And it seems that here we are, we've had to just be, we seem just really unwilling to recognize the gravity of the Earth changes and what we've done to the environment until it is so in our face that we finally are starting to band together. And that this, you do imply in your book that perhaps Mother Nature is, in fact, this is all part of the process of the rising human consciousness. That it's not an accident that we've taken to the planet to this limit.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like an initiatory cat crisis. You know, so in shamanism, people go out on these kind of initiations and, you know, kind of put themselves at risk to, you know, to a higher level. So it almost seems like the collective, on a species level, we're going through a kind of initiatory process. And I guess once you've done that once, you don't necessarily have to do it again, you know, just like... So maybe once we get through this process, we'll have learned how to act much more wisely in the future.
Yeah, we definitely need to act more wisely. What is the Global Consciousness Project from Princeton, and how does that tie in with the fatal event of 9/11?
Well, the Global Consciousness Project, I think it's not going at the moment, but they put random number generators in cities around the planet. I mean, there's been a lot of statistical evidence.
I have to interrupt you. Can you speak more clearly? We really have a bad sound from your phone.
The Global Consciousness Project was an effort to measure kind of the psychic effects of human consciousness or connectivity of human consciousness.
The what?
So they put 50 random number generators in towns and cities across the planet, because there have been a lot of statistical studies that have created evidence that human consciousness affects random number generators, whether in casinos or in laboratory experiments. So they put these number generators around the planet, and then they just measured them consistently to see what patterns would emerge. And they discovered that when there were kind of global events, whether crises or disasters or sporting events, the number generators would go off patterns of randomness and would begin to create other types of patterns, coherence. And then they found that the largest pattern that deviated from statistical randomness happened at 9/11/2001. So the leader of the project came up with a hypothesis that they were measuring a kind of nascent formation of a global collective consciousness that was psychic. And then it was also interesting that not only did the sort of change of the pattern develop and become much worse after, you know, the planes hit the building, the change began several hours before the planes hit the building. So it's almost like there was a precognitive awareness on the part of the global mind.
I see. I've picked up most of that, but unfortunately we've really got a bad connection with your telephone. So those of you who want to know more about this Global Consciousness Project, you're going to want to read Daniel's book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, to get all the details. It's a very fascinating aspect of this work. Okay. You openly discuss your various experiences with hallucinogens as part of your awakening consciousness. And I am very interested in this, and particularly with your description of ayahuasca, which many people are learning about and working with now. As far as you have worked with shamans with this plant, because I think that it's very exciting to have the guidance of shamans taking you through the essence of the plant. Where was it that you took your ayahuasca journeys? That was in Ecuador?
I did it in Ecuador, in the Amazon there, with the Sequoia tribe. And I also worked in Brazil with the Santa Daime in the Amazon. And Santa Daime is...
In where?
In Brazil, in the Amazon.
Where was that?
Brazil.
Uh-huh, okay.
With the Santo Daime, which is a religion that uses ayahuasca as a sacrament.
Uh-huh. Can you describe this experience to us?
They were very different. The tribal groups do them you're in sort of like a ceremonial lodge, lying in a hammock. And you have these visions while the shamans sing these kind of tribal spirit songs. The Santo Daime, you wear white, and you're all in this ceremony where you sing the whole night these special hymns that the Daime create. And the men and the women are separate. The lights are kept on bright. So the two experiences are very different.
What was your experience?
Well, I've had many experiences. I've done it about maybe 30 times. And I've had a range of just beautiful visionary experiences, different types of insights, healing. I think that the ayahuasca ceremony is one of the greatest things.
How would you compare ayahuasca to the LSD experiences you had earlier on?
All the psychedelics are very distinct, and ayahuasca is a little bit more like entering kind of a liquid current of kind of dream and imagination. LSD is a little bit more hard-edged and is somehow more analytical.
I see. And then you talk about DMT as being the sort of the most I understood that this was one of the most powerful of these chemicals, which you referred to a research study in which the suggestion was made that DMT could be the spirit molecule that links the brain to the afterlife. Is that right?
Yeah, DMT, dimethyltryptamine, is a chemical that is in our brains and spinal columns. It's also made by a lot of plants. It's part of the ayahuasca brew. And if you extract DMT and you smoke it, or I guess inject it, you go on a very, very short, very, very powerful journey where you really feel like you're catapulted into another dimension of reality. And it can be quite frightening or ecstatic. And this Dr. Rick Straussman wrote a book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. And in that book, he proposed that it might be, right, a sort of conductive medium between the physical and the astral. And he noted that in a lot of Buddhist texts, they talk about the soul reincarnating 7 weeks after death. And the pineal gland appears in fetal development exactly 49 days, 7 weeks after conception. And the pineal gland seems to be where DMT is stored and released. That was part of what led him to make that that hypothesis.
You talking about Michael Glickman?
Michael Glickman is a crop circle researcher. Do you know him?
I'm sorry, your voice is cutting out, and I'm getting like every second word.
I don't know what to do. I'm sorry. I can't.
Just keep talking, I guess.
I don't know.
I didn't understand. Who were you referring to when you were talking about the spirit molecule?
Rick Straussman wrote a book called DMT, the Spirit
Rick
Molecule.
Rick Straussman, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the experience that you had with DMT, you spoke about the demon, or you actually, it's written the diamond. Am I pronouncing it? It should be pronounced the demon, right?
I like diamond, actually. Make it a little distinct.
Oh, diamond, okay. You described this astral being actually materializing in your life. And I'd like you to describe this to us, because I'm very interested in astral beings and how they transcend the dimensions. And I'd like to know if you could share with us a little bit more about how and what that was about. How that happened and what was it about?
First of all, that wasn't an experience through DMT. It was a different chemical compound called DPT, which is dipropyltryptamine. That was actually a synthetic chemical distinct from DMT. Do you understand me?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So it was a different chemical, not DMT. And so, yes, I had this experience where I took DPT with a friend, and we both had the sense that we were being kind of assaulted by some kind of occult forces or occult energies. And then after that experience, I began to have visions. It was like I didn't close back up after the drug ended, but something from that world stayed with me. And so I began to have visions with my eyes closed, or just the sense of being in this other state. And then I also, at a certain point, began to have these poltergeist phenomena and a lot of dreams about this figure that was pursuing me. And ultimately, I had my friend come back, and we did a kind of exorcism ritual to kind of deal with this energy. And then at a certain point, I felt that I had...
Did you go back? Did you do another trip to back with that chemical, or did you have someone come in to assist you in cutting that entity out?
I mean, we didn't do another trip with the substance. We did a kind of ritual of absorption or something, and it felt more like I integrated or absorbed the energy rather than cutting it off.
Mm. And do you get a lot of... I'm curious to know if this aspect of your work, if you find that you get a lot of resistance to the brilliance of your observations and your journeys because of the use of psychedelics. I'd like to ask you that, you know, how do you deal with people that have I don't want to say a problem, because I'm sure you tell them, if you've got a problem, it's not my problem. But how do you integrate the fact that so much of your very profound experiences are based with psychedelics?
Well, it's been a little bit less of a problem than maybe I expected. I think partially because I wrote about it in my first book, Breaking Open the Head. That was the main focus of my first book. So, I don't know, it's at this point, if people are interested in what I'm saying, they seem to be willing to take the ride. I guess I got some caustic reviews in the mainstream media, but generally I'm finding that people are relieved that somebody is actually talking about these experiences. And generally, I'm finding that there's a major change in the cultural perception and tone around psychedelics, that there's no longer this kind of repressive negativity, but actually people are very curious and open once again. And I think that it may just have been enough time since the psychedelic experience. And also, you know, when we look at, you know, as in the 60s, when the people got into psychedelics, because as a response, you know, to the Vietnam War and the intensity of the time, you know, we're in another time of great intensity, and it kind of forces people or opens people to question, what the meaning of society is and what the meaning of their lives are. So I think for that reason, there's a lot more interest and acceptance of psychedelics than there were a few years ago.
Yeah, and I think also that we're not talking about drugs for recreational uses, but for seeking meaning and insight into the multidimensional life. So I think that probably also is, it's just, it's time. I think that let people are judging others, and at least within the, let's say within, I hate to say groups, but let's say within the part of humankind who is definitely seeking a spiritual understanding of life. Anyway, I still laud you for your openness to describe these experiences and integrate them into your work. And also the fact that you, I too have spent a lot of time with shamans, particularly the Mayans, and I have never tried ayahuasca, but I am very curious about that. I was intrigued by the fact that you started to channel Quetzalcoatl.
I did have this experience down in the Amazon in Brazil. I guess it started in Brasilia. Where this voice spoke to me, and I received this transmission, which is in the book.
So you actually had a channel experience. Was that on a journey as well with ayahuasca?
Yeah, it was over the course of maybe a week. I mean, it started during an ayahuasca ceremony, and it was during a week where I was working with this religion, the Santo Daime. And parts of the text or transmission began to come to me during dreams and during ceremonies, and began to piece this whole message together.
So then you're open to channeled material as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to channeled material. I don't necessarily, take anything as like having ultimate truth or validity. I think that we have to keep using our, intellect and discrimination, and also just because somebody has a channeled experience, that's very powerful for them. It doesn't mean that the information is good information or helpful information, or even if it's from a spiritual entity or psychic entity, doesn't necessarily mean that that entity is benevolent or has our best interests at heart.
I agree completely. It's very easy to bring in lower astral information, and many people are doing that, and it can be disguised sometimes as being light beings, but it isn't necessarily that at all. So I think people need to be very discerning.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same with shamanism. Shamans in the traditional, context could be very ambiguous figures. They could be helpers and healers, or they could be kind of, killers and dangerous. They were often very much feared. So it's because we're now in the modern West, we're sort of taking back, we're sort of re-entering this whole world of the psyche. We tend to be a little bit naive about how those things actually work.
Yeah, I agree with you. How? What do you mean by they can be dangerous, the shamans?
Oh, I mean, it's just that shamans are people who are able to kind of work with these different energies and travel in these other dimensions. And in the Amazon, they would often be kind of at the outskirts of the tribe. People would only go to them if they had a real compelling need, because they were also feared as, potentially just being dangerous on various levels.
Have you had any experiences with such ones, or have you been fortunate in selecting the people that you've been drawn to?
I've been pretty fortunate. My first experience in Africa with a shaman was complex. He was kind of demanding like more money from us during the ceremony and screaming a lot and stuff like that. But I've also seen the way, it's very subtle, but I think there are ways that ayahuasca use, you know, can lead to kind of ego inflation or, you know, so, you know, it can do things to people that are not just helpful and healing. So it's just like anything, you know, these things are tools, and just like the computer is a tool that you can, you know, do good things with or waste your time on, you know, the psychedelics are also tools that have, you know, positive and negative uses.
Yeah, I think that one of the most important messages that we can give out to people at this time is to not be naive, to be discerning, and to always intend that the highest good be served before being mesmerized by phenomenon. Much more important to be aware of intent than to be mesmerized by phenomena.
Hello?
Yeah, are you with me?
Yeah, hi.
This is some fun doing this by phone, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, okay. Daniel, let's talk about the crop circle. You've discussed in the book a number of different formations. One of the most interesting to me was the Jill Bolton face, which most of my audience know about. You give a lot of different possibilities for the crop circles and very unbiased information. I would like to know, what meanings you glean personally from the circle?
Well, yeah, I guess ultimately the thesis that I developed is that they seem to be a kind of a teaching on the nature of consciousness and the nature of reality. And, you know, that teaching seems to be one that's being given to us by, you know, a galactic, other forms of galactic intelligence. And part of what they seem to be indicating is the, you know, the stuff that what I mentioned with Quetzalcoatl, this idea of integration. You know, so you'll see sacred symbols that are also fractals or kind of merging between sacred symbols and modern mathematical ideas and stuff. So yeah, they seem to support the larger thesis of the book that I was developing.
And when was the last time you were in a circle formation?
I was in there last summer.
Were you? I was there too. Which circle formation did you get into? Did you manage to make it into the I can't remember the name of it. Milk Hill formation? It was only up a few days and the farmer took it down.
I don't think I made that. I don't think so.
Which ones did you visit?
Did
you see the butterfly?
I saw the butterfly. I don't think I went into that. I actually not really remembering which ones I went into. I was with friends and I wasn't really writing about it this time, so I wasn't as focused on it somehow.
Did you have any deeply profound experiences in the circles of last year?
No. There was one actually where there was a sighting of a kind of a silver ball that was moving around in the field. But personally, I did not see the ball myself with my own eyes, though I later saw it on video or in film. But it was kind of amusing because I was with a good friend of mine who's a researcher who's become very skeptical about the phenomenon, and he actually did see this strange ball kind of moving among the crops. So that was quite fun.
I guess it was. It would be interesting to do a psychedelic in the crop circle. Have you ever done that?
I have not, but it would be interesting.
It would be, because it would be interesting to see in that setting what kind of visions and energies would be perceived.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, talking about intergalactic communication, you also talk about the different abduction reports. And I would like to ask you how you perceive alien intervention on our planet. I know that's a pretty vast question, but what do you believe about these abduction reports?
Well, I don't really believe anything about them. I'm still trying to understand it myself, and I keep looking at new books and new information. It seems to be very hard to get a grasp on. Right now I've been looking at Stephen Greer's work, and I've also been reading Michael Sarian's work, and I don't really have like a set answer at this moment. A lot of people seem to think that the sort of greys who are performing these abductions are not actual not sort of living beings, but are more like biological automatons that may actually be constructed by some other group, whether it's the U.S. government or some other group of aliens. And Sarian proposes that the Nephilim were an alien race that sort of were hiding out on Earth and ended up performing these genetic manipulations that have kind of led to our present situation and are now desperately seeking a way to get off the planet. And his ideas dovetail very well with Richard Hoagland's recent book, Dark Mission, about the moon. Which looks at these very strange and occult aspects to our moon program and NASA and this kind of meeting of Freemasons and SS rocket scientists led to the moon program. So I don't know. I definitely, it seems like there are different agencies working here. And it definitely feels that some of them are not benevolent. And on the other hand, there may be other agencies that are kind of waiting for us to kind of awaken until they introduce themselves.
Yeah, well, in my work, it's described as having us understand that in any 3D reality, there is the nature of 3D reality is duality. And so if we're going to be thinking about ETs, we need to be thinking about potentially dark and light and get over it already. Because I don't personally adhere to the concept of being invaded by dark aliens are going to take over the planet. Neither do I believe that all of them are benevolent space brothers that have come in to sweep us out of danger, take us to safety. In fact, we created this, whatever we're in. We is our creation, and nobody needs to save us from ourselves. So, but it is interesting that, 100,000 people have, something like 100,000 people have reported these experiences, and it seems that more and more people are having these close encounters. And, of course, we have more and more sightings now as well of craft. And so it does feel like it's accelerating and that soon something is going to happen. Would you agree?
On
a global scale, like total content.
I think it's possible. Yeah, it does seem, as you said, that something is accelerating right now, but I guess there have been other periods of acceleration in the past, and then it kind of retreats again. So I don't know. We just have to be, in some way or other, kind of preparing ourselves psychically or through whatever research we can do to get a better handle on the situation?
Well, it would be certainly a factor that would propel us into a new consciousness. This theme keeps coming up on all of my shows. If we indeed do have global contact, it would be one fast track into a new awareness of our role in the galaxy. I'm sure you'll agree with that.
Of course. I think there's already plenty.
Imagine if we just have global contact all over the planet at the same time. Should be very interesting possibility.
Well, yeah, I think there's already plenty of evidence that, you know, that there's something going on. But my own perspective is that until sort of human consciousness advances to the point where we can take care of the biosphere independently, you know, we're not going to have any kind of positive global contact. You know, so I think that we have to take care of the crisis at hand. And once we've kind of shown ourselves, you know, to be a kind of adult species, then perhaps we will.
I agree with that. We certainly don't want to. The current welcoming committee on this planet would not invite the highest of vibrations from outsiders. In your book, you talk about the transition as being time speeding up, synchronicities, more premonitions, and light events. Now, these light events, are you referring to sightings?
I don't remember discussing light events. I don't know what you're thinking about.
Oh, there's a passage in the book that says that the transition, someone that you interviewed or that you referred to talks about time speeding up. The four elements of the transition, predominant elements, would be time speeding up, more synchristic events, premonitions, and light events, which I didn't understand, actually. Maybe I didn't read it correctly. I was kind of racing through it so that I was prepared for this interview.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But I'll go back and check it out.
Yeah, I'm not sure about light events. I mean, I think that might be Michael Glickman, and he also talks about sort of the karmic, the elastic rubber band karma seems to be snapping back faster and faster. And also, you know, the whole idea of the apocalypse, the word means a revealing or uncovering. You know, so in that sense, things become increasingly clear and transparent. Becomes harder to hide anything.
Ah, okay. But overall, you do have a very optimistic sense about you that what we are talking about here is not the apocalyptic scenario, but an opportunity for humankind to create another reality, yeah? Am I reading correctly here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I just see it as we have a window of opportunity to catalyze a shift in global consciousness. And to take that opportunity requires, you know, a lot of active work and awakening. And I definitely think there's a possibility that, you know, that awakening is not going to happen, in which case things would become potentially very, very distressing, you know, as they already have become in some respects, but, you know, exponentially worse. So it does seem like a kind of race, or it's almost like, you know, God is putting on a good movie, you know, where it gets down to the last second before we see what the outcome is.
It seems to be the nature of the human being that we go all the way to the limit and then bounce back. And let's hope that this 2012 fatidic date comes and goes, and with it we understand that we have definitely moved into through the window. And let's hope that behind this window is quite a brilliant light, because we are so ready. We are so needy of a great shift, and hopefully we will be ready. The book is 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. The author is Daniel Pinchbeck. Daniel, believe it or not, we're just about out of time, and I'd like to ask you if you have one thought that you want to leave with my audience before we sign out tonight, what would that be?
I don't know if I have one great thought. I mean, I would like to suggest that they check out a web magazine that I started, which is called Reality Sandwich. It's at realitysandwich.com. And I'm also working on an animation and video project, which is can be found at postmoderntimes.com. So those are my two little enterprises right now, besides the writing.
Sorry, I didn't hear that well. Is that postmoderntimes.com?
Yeah, exactly. Postmoderntimes.com, and the web magazine is realitysandwich.com.
Okay, that sounds good. He's a prolific writer. You can check in and see what Daniel is bringing forth. I'm gonna read the other book now, Daniel. As soon as I finish this one, I'm very fascinated about that too. Breaking Open the Head. And I feel very, very blessed to have found you and very grateful that you agreed to come on my show. And once again, the website is?
Oh, yeah, thank you very much for having me, by the way. But the website is realitysandwich.com.
Realitysandwich.com. Check him out. Thank you, Daniel. Am I going to see you in the Crop Circle this summer?
You very well may. We'll stay in
touch.
Well,
please keep in touch so that we can.
Yeah.
I would really enjoy the opportunity to go into one with you.
Okay, great. Yeah, we'll talk about that.
We'll try to make that happen. Okay. Thank you for being with us. Don't miss next week's show. We have Nicholas Hager, the author of the book The Syndicate. This is the story of the subtitle is The Story of the Coming World Government. So all of you conspiracy buffs out there, you're going to want to listen to this show. Coming to you again Sunday night my time in Italy, 12 o'clock California time in the States. Thank you so much for listening in. Thank you again to Daniel Pinchbeck, a prolific writer and a very wise man. Good night, everybody. I'll talk to you on Sunday. Don't forget, do not ever stop breaking through the confines of the convention and bringing your brain, your spirit, your soul, out beyond the matrix. This is Pat Corey signing out. Don't forget to visit me at www.syrianrevelations.net.